Grand Rapids Public Utilities. Proceeds benefit the United Way School Pantry Coalition, a network of 11 schools addressing student hunger with nutritious snacks and weekend meals. uwlakes.org/lumberjack. Northland Arboretum in Brainerd offers guided hikes the third Thursday of each month at 9:30 a.m. Hikes are 1 hour long and dogs are welcome on a leash.
Efforts are hampered not just by recurring disasters, but by the fact that Afghanistan is facing a humanitarian crisis.
A 6.0 magnitude earthquake devastated eastern Afghanistan overnight, killing hundreds. For Monday, September 1st, this is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers. On this Labor Day, there are protests in Chicago. President Trump says the city needs to do more to address crime and enforce immigration laws. He suggested he may send the National Guard to the city. And later, a look at what some people call AI slop. More and more videos online are now made with artificial intelligence.
I think that discoverability on the internet has already started to collapse.
And soul singer Kirby is out with the new album, Miss Black America. She taps into her Mississippi roots.
You can feel the past in the present in Mississippi, and so I wanted to really bring that to the track.
First, the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Amy Held. Lawmakers are back on Capitol Hill this week after an August recess that was marked by voter frustration. NPR's Claudia Grisales reports many constituents voiced concerns over the economy and other hot-button issues at town hall meetings.
Lawmakers faced blowback from constituents to address rising prices, fueled in part by President Trump's tariffs, and concerns that changes at the Federal Reserve could put further strain on the economy. Many also pushed back on Trump's signature bill passed this summer, concerned about cuts to Medicaid and other government spending. However, the hardest job on tap for lawmakers may be averting a government shutdown tied to a September 30th deadline. Claudia Rizales, NPR News.
U.S. colleges and universities are facing a steep drop in international student enrollment this fall. As Frank Morris of member station KCUR reports, it comes after a Trump administration crackdown on student visas.
Last year, well over a million international students helped American schools pay the bills. But President Trump's State Department has aggressively denied and revoked student visas. University of North Florida economist Madeline Zavodny says the sharp drop in foreign students is hitting American universities already facing plunging domestic enrollment.
This is a big problem for colleges and universities, again, from small privates to big publics that have increasingly emphasized recruiting students from abroad.
The final enrollment numbers aren't in, but Savani says the expected drop could cost the U.S. economy some $7 billion and force some small private universities to close. For NPR News, I'm Frank Morris.
The United Nations is appealing for international aid for victims of Afghanistan's earthquake that struck around midnight last night. At least 800 people were killed, more injured, with casualties expected to rise. NPR's Omkar Kandekar reports.
Spokesperson of UN's refugee agency, Babar Baloch, said the earthquake came at a time the country was already reeling from a drought and forced expulsion of millions of Afghans from the neighboring Pakistan and Iran. He said the scale of the disaster far exceeds the capacity of the local authorities. Since roads are obstructed and mobile networks cut off in many places, aid workers are forced to go on foot to reach victims in remote villages. Afghanistan is vulnerable to earthquakes because of its location at the intersection of two major tectonic plates. An earthquake in the country's west in 2022 killed more than 1,000 people. Omkar Khandekar, NPR News, Mumbai.
Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi and Russian President Vladimir Putin met on the sidelines of a regional summit in China today in a show of deepening ties. New Delhi's ties with Washington have been strained over the purchase of Russian oil. This is NPR News. Mexico is about to mark a significant new chapter in its democracy. NPR's Eder Peralta reports tonight, judges who were elected by the people will take over the federal judiciary.
Constitutional scholars say this is an unprecedented experiment in a democracy. Usually democracies try to insulate their judges from politics. Mexican voters instead approved a constitutional amendment that made all judges directly elected by the people and through the judiciary straight into the political arena. By this evening, the whole federal judiciary will be replaced with judges who were elected in June. The country's new Supreme Court Chief Justice will be Hugo Aguilar Ortiz, who grew up herding goats in southern Mexico. To critics, this change means the erosion of checks and balances. Supporters say in a country where justice is rare, it now makes the judiciary responsive to ordinary citizens. Ada Peralta, NPR News, Mexico City.
At the Nevada Arts and Music Festival Burning Man, police say they're investigating the death of a man as a homicide. He was found this weekend in what police say appears to be an isolated incident, but they urged festival goers to remain vigilant. Burning Man, which brings in tens of thousands of visitors to the Black Rock Desert annually, ends today. The western U.S. is dealing with above-average warmth. Forecasters say parts of the Pacific Northwest are likely to experience a possibly record-breaking heat wave with triple-digit highs. But in the northern plains and Midwest, a strong cold front midweek is forecast to send temperatures plummeting by as much as 25 degrees below normal this week. It's NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Lilly Endowment, a private foundation supporting NPR's coverage of religion and spirituality, and Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts.
It is 6 minutes past the hour, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Support for this program comes from Sanford Health, with primary care locations in Bemidji and across the Upper Midwest. Sanford Health is committed to providing care close to home. Learn more at sanfordhealth.org. And coming up at 5:30, it's going to be the Up North Report from our KAXE KBXE news team. Now back to All Things Considered.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers. Labor Day marches were held across the country today from small towns to major cities. Some of the largest protests were held in Chicago. Labor unions organized the main march there, but it expanded to include opposition to President Trump, saying he'll send in federal agents and possibly the National Guard to enforce immigration laws and make the city safe. WBEZ reporter Mariah Wolfel joins us from Chicago. Hi there.
Hi, Juana.
So, Mariah, I understand that several city leaders addressed the crowd, including Mayor Brandon Johnson, and I heard he's pretty fired up.
Yeah, Johnson really thrives at political rallies. You know, he cut his teeth as a teachers union organizer, and he started his speech shouting and he ended his speech shouting. And, you know, as the president threatens to send in military force to apparently fight crime and enforce immigration in Chicago, Johnson sounded as if he was preparing for battle. You know, he really sees Trump's threats to send in military force as a threat to the Constitution himself. And that was the Constitution itself. And that was apparent in his remarks.
Are you prepared to defend this land that was built by slaves, a land that was built by indigenous people, a land that is built by workers? Are you prepared to defend this land?
You know, Johnson really sees the unified labor movement as this clapback to Trump's cuts to Medicaid, even to SNAP, his deportation campaign. And this is really in line with Johnson's overall politics, that many of the divisive issues in our country, according to him, come down to this war between workers and billionaires who he argues exploit labor and worsen the wealth gap in our country.
Now, Mariah, you were out there in the crowds talking to people. What did you hear from them about why they decided to come out and march today?
Yeah, so many people came from different corners of the city, from young leftist organizers to pro-Palestinian organizers to older generations of union workers who see Trump as a threat to good-paying labor jobs. You know, groups of people who locally may have disagreements and different interests, but were united today. And the energy was just sort of off the charts. And I think, you know, frankly, doing this on Labor Day was a smart way for organizers to merge all of these causes. Chicago is a huge labor town. town. Mm-hmm. And the march started at the Haymarket Memorial, which is a monument in honor of the victims of the 1886 Haymarket bombing that targeted a pro-labor demonstration. And protesters kind of said fighting against Trump policies and celebrating Labor Day go, quote, hand in glove.
Mm. It sounds like there were a lot of different concerns really on people's mm-hmm. minds out there. Was there any one message that sort of cut through?
You know, the biggest concern and obviously the most urgent one I heard was that they don't want the National Guard in the city. You know, I spoke with one protester, John Kelleher, who's a building inspector and longtime Chicagoan. And this was the message that he said he wanted Trump to hear.
Well, number one, that we don't need the National Guard in Chicago. We haven't historically and we don't now. The police can handle it. Chicago cops are the best. And that labor is a force to be reckoned with.
You know, this was also just a general outlet for people disturbed by some of Trump's policies across the board, including his campaign against immigration. And I asked people whether they're worried that actions like this will actually provoke the president to send the National Guard into Chicago. But almost everyone I spoke to said, you know, the president is going to do what he's going to do and that Chicagoans don't really, you know, shut up in the face of threats. So I think there was this general pride around expressing right. what they see as Chicago's values.
That was WBEZ reporter Mariah Wolfel in Chicago. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
The European Union is blasting Russia for allegedly interfering with the navigation system of a plane carrying the European Commission president yesterday. She was visiting countries on the bloc's eastern flank. Terry Schultz reports it's just the latest act of sabotage on European targets that's been attributed to Moscow.
European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen's plane had to circle for an extra hour before it could deposit her and her team safely in the Bulgarian capital. With its GPS system jammed, journalists on board the flight said the pilots had to pull out paper maps to make the landing at Plovdiv Airport in Sofia. Almost 24 hours after the incident, Bulgaria pointed a finger at the Kremlin, accusing it of being responsible. European Commission spokesperson Arianna Podesta condemned the act as part of the threats and intimidations that have become, quote, a regular component of Russia's hostile behavior.
This incident actually underlines the urgency of the mission that the president is carrying out in the frontline member states these days. There she has seen firsthand the everyday challenges of threats coming from Russia and its proxies.
Moscow has not publicly responded to these allegations, but Podesta says if Russian actors are to blame and thought Europeans would be intimidated by the dangerous stunt, they're wrong.
This will only reinforce even further our unshakable commitment to ramp up defense capabilities and support for Ukraine. And of course, the EU will continue to invest into defense spending and in Europe's readiness even more after this incident.
It may also be a wake-up call for those Europeans who doubt the threat Russia can pose to everyday life, says Vesela Chernova, the deputy director of the European Council on Foreign Relations based in Sofia. Chernova says despite a growing number of small attacks of sabotage throughout Europe linked to Russia, public opinion in some countries is still divided about how to respond and the need to protect their societies.
I hope in the end it's going to produce a EU policy that is going to contribute to the resilience of the countries, especially those here around the front line. And I'm not talking about simply about GPS jamming, you know, but about the plethora of possibilities for hybrid attacks that can really undermine citizens' security.
But even as Russia is being blamed for staging the jamming attack, Chernova says there may be domestic repercussions as well. Opposition politicians are calling for the head of Bulgaria's National Intelligence Agency to resign for failing to stop Sunday's incident. For NPR News, I'm Terry Schultz in Brussels.
A 6.0 magnitude earthquake struck eastern Afghanistan on Sunday, leaving death and widespread destruction in its path. The epicenter of the quake was just outside the city of Jalalabad, near Afghanistan's border with Pakistan. Officials in Afghanistan say it will take more time to determine the number of deaths and injuries. What is the response on the ground now, and how might Afghanistan, a country already dealing with extreme poverty, move forward in the days and months to come? For more insight, we're joined now by Shireen Ibrahim. She's the International Rescue Committee's country director for Afghanistan, and she joins us now from Kabul. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Anna.
If I understand correctly, this is an area that is rather mountainous. Does that pose additional challenges for doing rescue operations in the area?
Of course, the roads have been quite destroyed, and as a result, it's been very difficult to get the heavy machinery required to remove some of the roadblocks that have resulted from the earthquake. So what we're hearing today is that some segments of the roads have been reopened, especially around some of the easier to reach locations. But we are more concerned about the isolated communities in particular locations that are now partially or fully decimated. So houses, infrastructure, all gone. Travel time would be about 3 to 5 hours. And unfortunately prolonged now because of the destruction that we're currently seeing.
Given the fact that Afghanistan is very prone to earthquakes and had been hit by a series of deadly earthquakes in the last decade, I wonder if those earthquakes and whether the country is still recovering from them and if that will complicate the recovery from this most recent earthquake.
So you're right to say that Afghanistan has been unfortunately impacted by several of these geophysical disasters, the last being in Herat in 2023. The reality, Wana, is that the rescue and recovery efforts are hampered not just by these recurring disasters, but by the very fact that Afghanistan is facing a humanitarian crisis of epic proportions.
Yes.
Before the earthquake of last night, Afghanistan had a population of 23 million people in need, and many of whom are suffering from acute food insecurity, don't have basic health care, and children in the millions are suffering from malnutrition. So the resources that exist today are very stretched, and the services that are provided for the majority of the Afghan people are extremely, extremely restricted. And as such, obviously, to top it off, a geophysical disaster like the one we experienced last night just devastates the ability of humanitarian actors to provide for the millions of people who are already suffering.
The Trump administration has canceled more than $1 billion in promised humanitarian aid to Afghanistan. How will these cuts affect efforts on the ground from organizations like yours?
Well, I wanted your listeners to also appreciate that the U.S. government and its people have provided almost 50% of all humanitarian funding over the course of decades to Afghanistan. Cut short, obviously, with the executive orders. I have to say that the current funding is so restricted that we have to make very difficult choices. Afghanistan is the largest displacement crisis in Asia, and it is the sixth most vulnerable country when it comes to climate. So an earthquake to top it all off without the necessary resources means that we are struggling to prioritize, we're struggling to save lives, but at the end of the day, we can only do so much.
We've been speaking with Shireen Ibrahim. She's the International Rescue Committee's country director for Afghanistan. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Anna.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 5:18, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE, People Powered Radio. My name is Andrew DeZingle. Thanks to our listeners, we've raised over $162,000 during this crisis caused by federal cuts to public media. KXE is working hard to keep the programming you love going strong. Every action helps. Donate, share our work, or buy a ticket to Grand Rapids Riverfest. Visit KAXE.org. Support for KAXE comes from the IM Hotel in Grand Rapids, providing access to local attractions and outdoor activities like fishing and bike trails. Additional information available at imhoteltimberlake.com. Local author Anne Marie Erickson celebrates the launch of her new book, In the Evening We'll Dance, a memoir and essays on love and dementia. Thursday, September 4th at 7 p.m. at the McCrosty Arts Center in Grand Rapids. Erickson will read brief excerpts of a book and sign copies. Donating stocks and mutual funds is a quick, easy way to defend KAXE from funding cuts. You may receive tax benefits as well. Call Sarah for details at 218-326-1234. The Metsa Garden in Virginia has a fall plant sale and produce swap Friday, September 5th from 8 to 1. The garden is located on Bailey Lake on 3rd Street North. McCrosty Arts Center in Grand Rapids hosts an opening reception for the group exhibit Expressing Grief, Friday, September 5th from 4 to 7 p.m. Five regional artists come together to honor the experience of grief in its many forms. The Virginia Area Historical Society's annual Fall Fest is Saturday, September 6th in the Lions Club building at Olcott Park, starting at 4 p.m. with grilled burgers and brats. The featured speaker is Mark Sage, who will talk about Frank Higgins, one of many sky pilots during the logging era.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the University of Maryland Libraries, dedicated to making UMD's research available to everyone and advancing open access for the public good. More at lib.umd.edu. And from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, RWJF is a national philanthropy working toward a future where health is no longer a privilege, but a right. Learn more at rwjf.org. This is NPR.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. The soul singer Kirby was born Kirby Lauren Dockery, and that last name connects her to the Dockery Plantation in Mississippi, where her enslaved ancestors picked cotton. Now, as a songwriter, Kirby has collaborated with other artists, from Beyoncé to Paul McCartney, but her new solo album, Miss Black America, is grounded deep in her family's Mississippi soil. It opens with what sounds like an invocation.
There's just quiet tension in the air. Mississippi is a very beautiful place, but I think there's a frequency in the beauty that you can also kind of hear, like, something happened here. You can feel the past in the present in Mississippi, and so I wanted to really bring that to the track.
It's such an interesting, imaginative, creative project to take a place and a feeling and translate it into sound. But when that place is Mississippi, there's this long, long history of sound and music that comes out of that place. So how much are you trying to tap into that as opposed to just saying, what's the feeling I get when I see this place and what does that sound like as I express it through music?
Right. I've known for quite some time that my last name is associated with the Dockery Plantation, which they call the birthplace of the blues. Mm-hmm. I felt a need to honor that. I mean, I get the joke all the time that says, oh, Kirby, you make, quote unquote, Negro spiritual music, slave music. And I think that's such a sad way to describe the sounds that came out of our pain and struggle in that time. When I sing the way that I do, I'm really not even going necessarily that far back. I'm going back to my childhood. And we was a foot-stomping old wood, red pew, stained glass type of church. And a lot of times before the service would start, it would just be stumping and just kind of moaning and groaning. And so for me, when I think of like what Mississippi, I don't want to say black pain, but truly, Mississippi Southern experience, it sounds like that to me.
Let's talk about the song Better Days, because to me, This almost feels like a mission statement for the album, where you sing, I just want to make the ancestors proud.
I want my ancestors looking like, hey girl, you're living out our dreams, you've seen the whole world. For all the pain we lived, you made it worth it. You've seen the happy end, you made us proud, proud, yeah.
I think for me, the Dark Reforms experience really changed how I viewed music and ownership. And that was years ago, maybe even 8 years ago, when I first went on that ground and I saw how all these talented blues musicians, people that they would say, you know, Howlin' Wolf, Charlie Patton, like these are the people who formed the blues and started the blues movement. To know that those people were never fairly compensated, that's when I really became very gung-ho about owning my masters, because I said to myself, it's not fair that the power and the importance of this land comes from people whose family will never financially benefit from what they essentially gave value. And so for me, my why is very clear as to who and what I'm doing music for.
The song Mama Don't Worry feels like it could be written to your own mother or to any mother or even to yourself. Will you tell us about it?
Oh, the last bar. Don't you get me crying, Ari, to myself. You know, I do have, I got a Pomeranian, honey. Maybe she could sing that to me. I don't know. I love it. You know, I promise that there's joy at the end of this call, but I just have to go through the grief in which we got this album, right? Because we were going through it, brother, I tell you, for a couple of years, and I think it just all came out in this music. But I never seen my mother cry like we did when my grandmother was passed.
Leave all that trauma, it ain't no good. If I could change it, no, I sure don't want to see you cry.
And I think just seeing my mom lose her mother and knowing that, you know, one day, ooh, honey, many, many decades from now, I hope, you know, that, you know, we all have to say goodbye at some point. And so just to be able to let her know in this present day and time that, Mama, I just don't want you to worry about anything. What you've instilled, what you've given to us, the way that you loved us was enough. I've spent a lot of time writing love letters to somebody, I mean, romantically, right, to a guy. But the sweetest one I think I've ever written was to my mom.
Mama.
You've built your career in such an interesting way that I think it says something about the music industry today, where you've had songs on TV shows like Insecure and The Bear. You were a voice actress on the show Swarm. You've got more than a million followers on TikTok. You've toured with artists like John Legend and Leon Bridges. So tell us a little bit about how you take your art and put it to work in the context of the business.
I think the one thing that I've had to learn is to respect the fact that this is art and to say, okay, Kirby, if you value this, you don't have to say yes to everything. And I think that's something when I was a songwriter, if you can see early in my career, I was just, honey, you know, you're hungry. You're like, listen, you want a song about, you know, chickens dancing? Okay, look, I'm gonna give you the best chicken dancing track ever in the world, you know? Like, you just write anything because you feel like I'm so hungry. But everything that you just listed in that moment, I can say that those were intentional yeses. And so I think my career, though sometimes it feels like to me I'm a slow burn, and I think I'm a slow cooker on the stove, honey, but the season and everything is gonna be just right. So that's how I like to perceive me being a slow burn. And I think that's why this record, you know, When You Coming Home, that's why all of these songs, they mean so much to me, because I could never deny my roots. I can never deny who I am from this project. And if there's ever a moment when I become unsure, I literally have the songs to remind me that, Kirby, this is what you are foundationally. Before you were formed, I truly believe this is what you are made of. I just hope I never question it again.
Kirby's new album is Miss Black America, and It has been such a pleasure talking to you about it. Thank you.
Oh, you're so kind.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 529, and you're tuned in to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. Coming up next is the Up North Report. We receive support from Clockout Brewing Company in Grand Rapids, making traditional old world styles of beer as well as modern classics for 7 years now. Their tap room is open Monday through Saturday, noon to 8, Sunday from noon to 6. More info at clockoutbrewing.com. Now it's time for the Up North Report.
For KAXE News, I'm Chelsea Perkins with a special edition of the Up North Report. After decades of development, the first mRNA vaccines ever used in the U.S. came during the COVID-19 pandemic, saving millions of lives. But Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. recently announced that the U.S. will pull $500 million in funding from mRNA research, citing false claims. Dr. Kausar Talat is an associate professor of global disease epidemiology and control at Johns Hopkins University, an infectious disease doctor, and a vaccine scientist. I spoke with her to learn more about what's at stake.
When we give people a little piece of the message that encodes for one of the viral proteins that goes into our arms, it goes into the cells, and then the cells make a little piece of the protein from the virus. It's not enough to make us sick. It doesn't last for very long, but what it does do, it doesn't belong inside of us. So it triggers the immune system to respond and make antibodies that will defend us against that virus when we see it again. And the reason why mRNA is so fantastic is it's really, really fast. And so when COVID-19 happened, we had two mRNA vaccines that have been tested in over 70,000 people and ready to give to people in December of 2020, so within a year.
What do we know about the safety of mRNA vaccines?
The mRNA vaccines were given to billions of people worldwide. So I don't think there's any vaccine that have been given to more people more quickly and for whom the safety has been monitored so closely ever. We know that there are some side effects. I got a sore arm. Some people get fevers. We know that there are incredibly rare side effects that can occur, but for the most part, the vaccines are very well tolerated and they have been clearly shown to save lives.
Recently, the federal government announced that the funding would be canceled into mRNA vaccine research. Can you just explain what the impact of that cancellation will be when it comes to treating these pandemics if we have another one?
So a lot of the funding that was canceled was for mRNA vaccines for bird flu. So bird flu came into North America several years ago, infected a lot of birds. In 2024, it started infecting cows, and there was huge outbreaks on dairy farms. Dozens of workers on those farms have been infected. And this is a virus that we're really all very concerned about and are worried that this would become the next pandemic virus. But it's not just that. Other mRNA vaccine trials have been canceled as well. And these are for diseases that we don't have vaccines for or we need better vaccines for. This just puts us behind when we don't need to be behind because of the political decisions that are being made instead of scientific decisions.
What advice would you have for anyone that has concerns about side effects and negative interactions?
People at the highest levels of our government are giving bad information. It's really hard to know who to trust. One thing that I would tell people is to talk to their doctors and talk to trusted health professionals and ask them what they think about vaccine safety, not talking heads on TV, YouTube, Instagram, TikTok.
If you had one takeaway, what would it be?
When we wake up in the morning and decide what to eat for breakfast, there's a small risk associated with that. We could choke on it. When we walk out the front door, we could get hit by a bus. There's always a risk. And that's true for any medicine that we take or any vaccines that we take. But the benefits to vaccines far, far outweigh any potential risks. My father, when he was a baby, was infected with polio. And there was no vaccine at the time. He was born before the vaccine was developed. Now he's in a wheelchair. He can't walk. My kids were vaccinated against polio, never experienced that. My generation in the United States has never experienced that. And I want that to be true for my grandkids as well. And the way that we're going, that could be at jeopardy. We're already seeing the largest measles outbreak in the United States in over 30 years. And we've had kids die of measles, which is 100% preventable.
That was Dr. Kausar Talat of Johns Hopkins University. That's it for this special edition of the Up North Report. I'm Chelsea Perkins, telling the stories of Northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report is sponsored by Woodland Bank, with locations in Grand Rapids, Cohasset, Hill City, and Deer River, dedicated to serving the financial needs of the community and their customers. More info at woodland.bank.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Wallace Foundation, an independent, nonpartisan research foundation collaborating with grantees and partners in the arts, school leadership, and youth development. More at wallacefoundation.org. From Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. At WTGrantFDN.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Juana Summers. President Trump has called on pharmaceutical companies to prove the success of vaccines used to prevent COVID-19. In a statement on social media, Trump wrote, quote, "Many people think they are a miracle that saved millions of lives. Others disagree. But as NPR's Kat Lonsdorf reports, in the past, Trump celebrated the vaccines."
Back in December of 2020, Trump stood at a podium in front of doctors, scientists, and politicians.
We're here to discuss a monumental national achievement.
And announced that both Pfizer and Moderna, two major drug companies, had developed COVID-19 vaccines that were around 95% effective.
This is one of the greatest miracles in the history of modern day medicine or any other medicine, any other age of medicine.
He said that every American who wanted a vaccine would be able to get a vaccine. But this morning, less than 5 years later, Trump appeared to raise doubts about the effectiveness of those very vaccines on his social media platform, demanding companies like Pfizer make information and results available to the public. It's unclear exactly what information he's talking about. NPR reached out to both Pfizer and Moderna for comment, but neither responded immediately. When asked for clarification, White House spokesperson Kush Desai told NPR that, quote, "The only driving principle of health decision-making in this administration is gold standard science."
Hi, it's Robert F. Kennedy Jr. here, your HHS secretary. At HHS, we have a division.
Last month, Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr., a longtime critic of vaccines, cut $500 million in funding for mRNA vaccines, effectively halting the advancement of the technology behind the current COVID vaccines.
HHS has determined that mRNA technology poses more risk and benefits for these respiratory viruses.
But experts say that's just not true. There's overwhelming evidence that mRNA vaccines are very safe and continue to protect people against respiratory illnesses. Kennedy also announced significant limits on who will be eligible for COVID vaccines last week, which added to a week of chaos at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention after Director Susan Menarez was forced out and several others resigned in protest. As Trump posted about vaccines this morning, several former CDC leaders from both Republican and Democratic administrations published an op-ed in the New York Times. In it, they expressed serious concern that Kennedy and his policies are endangering the health of Americans. Kat Lonsdorf, NPR News, Washington.
Tomorrow marks the 80th anniversary of the end of World War II. September 2nd, 1945, was the day Japan formally surrendered to the Allies. Except for a brief moment that day, the surrender ceremony hit a snag. All Things Considered producer Henry Larson has our story.
The official surrender happened on the deck of the USS Missouri.
the battleship anchored off the coast of Japan, flanked by other Allied ships.
In the bay of Tokyo itself, the United States destroyer Buchanan comes alongside, bringing representatives of the Allied powers to witness the final capitulation.
There is, on what is now known as the surrender deck, a table, and it is where the instrument of unconditional surrender is waiting to be signed by not only all of the Allied nations, but also the representatives of Japan.
That's journalist Murray Brewster.
I am the defense and foreign policy correspondent for the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation.
He notes that among the Allied representatives witnessing the Japanese surrender in 1945 was a Canadian colonel named Lawrence Cosgrave.
He is perhaps among the lowest ranking member of the military who would be present at that scene, or at least asked to be in the front row.
The time is 9:05 a.m. The Japanese have been on board exactly 10 minutes.
The Japanese signed the document first, and then came the Allies.
General MacArthur signs as Supreme Allied Commander.
Everyone has to sign on the dotted line, and all of the Allied partners had lined up to sign. They were allowed to come and sit down at the table where they would sign on behalf of their country.
Colonel Lawrence Moore Cosgrave for Canada.
He went to sign, but he missed his line. He signed below where his signature should be. The Japanese, when they saw that not all of the signatures were in the appropriate place, suggested to General MacArthur's chief of staff that they wouldn't accept the document.
The flub could have sparked a diplomatic incident, but it didn't. Someone came up with a fix, and the Japanese eventually relented. The damage to Cosgrave's legacy, though, was done.
Colonel Cosgrave is remembered as the signatory to the instrument of surrender who signed on the wrong line. And his passing in 1970 was noted in the New York Times as just that.
Brewster wanted to change that. He pored through the records that remained of Cosgrave's life at the Canadian War Museum. He learned the colonel had lost an eye many years before the day of the surrender and found a short book Cosgrave wrote about his service in the First World War.
He became a diplomat and traveled extensively in the Far East and was very culturally in tune with the countries of Japan and China.
It was partly those cultural connections that brought him to Tokyo Bay in 1945. And in the days leading up to that fateful moment, Cosgrave toured some of those same cities he had once visited as a diplomat.
And he was awed by the destruction.
Picture this man, half blind, having just seen what became of mainland Japan, surrounded by admirals and generals made famous by years of war.
Swarms of United States aircraft fly in formation overhead as the ceremony ends. The final United Nations victory has been won. The war is over. Peace is here.
He was overwhelmed because of the company he was in. That comes through very clearly in his official report to the federal government.
A report that makes no mention of his blunder. But Brewster says Cosgrave's story also serves as a lesson. Don't be so quick to judge.
We live in an age right now where there are instantaneous judgments about people and about their character. This soldier, diplomat, I won't give him the title of poet, but certainly a man with a poetic soul, is known to history as the man who signed on the wrong line. But his life was so much more than that.
Murray Brewster first wrote about Colonel Cosgrave for Legion magazine. Henry Larson, NPR News.
Two of the biggest names in tennis faced off today at the U.S. Open, Naomi Osaka versus Coco Gauff in the round of 16. Osaka won in a dominant performance. After the match, she told ESPN she looks up to Gauff.
I feel like to be such an amazing role model at such a young age is a gift, and it's a talent that she has, and I have all the respect in the world for her, so.
The two first met in 2019. Coco Gauff was only 15 then, playing in her first U.S. Open. Osaka was the world number one, 21 years old and the defending champion. Gauff lost that match and was teary-eyed. But just as Osaka was about to start her post-game interview, also with ESPN, she invited Gauff to join her. Osaka could see that the crowd loved Gauff and would want to hear from her.
She's been so sweet to me, so thank you for this. Thank you.
A lot has changed since then. Goff is now 21 and is the world's highest paid female athlete. Osaka took a break from the game and had a baby. These days, she's ranked 24th and returns to the court tomorrow for the U.S. Open quarterfinals. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Pediatricians and public health officials say lice is low on the list of threats to public health, but it can feel like a big deal to the school systems and parents struggling with the idea of keeping kids with lice in class. Blake Farmer of member station WPLN in Nashville reports.
A lice infestation is an ordeal, especially at a preschool.
Hey girl, how's your hair? Feeling okay?
Evelyn Thompson knows how to disarm four-year-olds, so they forget she's combing their hair looking for blood-sucking bugs the size of a sesame seed. Today, she's checking her work, methodically parting the hair of children she treated a week ago.
She was the first one we identified in the group, and I promised her she wouldn't be the only one.
And by the time we were finished, there were 13 children.
Tanya Bryson owns the daycare, Creative Youth Enrichment Center. When lice hit a third of her students, she knew the latest recommendations are to treat nits as a nuisance, not a public health threat. So they kept everyone in school and faced the dreaded four-letter word together.
It's not as bad as you think it is. I mean, yes, we had quite a few kids with it, and it went to parents and siblings, but it's manageable.
If you grew up in the 1900s, no nits was the policy, and you were sent home until you had a clean bill of health. But 20 years ago, medical guidance shifted to let kids stay in school. At this point, when live lice are found, the recommendation is to simply notify parents. Catherine Smith's the president-elect of the Tennessee Association of School Nurses.
They can come back to school for their education the next day. It's more important that they're in school learning than it is for them to be out of school because of lice.
After all, they're gross, but essentially harmless. Lice don't carry disease, they don't jump or fly, so if little heads aren't touching, lice are usually staying put. Plus, it takes weeks to go from one bug on a kid's head to enough live lice to make them really itchy. Pediatrician Dawn Nolt of Oregon Health and Science University authored a widely cited paper in 2022 that spawned a flurry of schools revisiting their no-nit policies.
Kicking them out on a Wednesday when they've been having it for the past 4 to 6 weeks is not going to do anything, but it's going to take that kid out of school and shame that kid and shame that family. And I just think that that's not acceptable.
Inclusion is the priority, even if it may cause an inconvenience or even financial cost for others. Over-the-counter treatments like gels, creams, and shampoos add up, and professional help can run into the hundreds of dollars since it could hit an entire household. Lice leniency is a tough sell, even for the experts.
My child's best friend canceled a play date because that person had lice. I was like, it's okay, just come. They were so embarrassed. And I said, okay, just get the treatment. We'll see you next week.
For school districts that dropped their no-nit policies, second thoughts are going around. Parents in Massachusetts, Texas, Ohio, and Georgia are petitioning for their schools to get strict on nits. And school boards are listening. The school board in Hernando County, Florida, is reverting to their old rules. Chair Shannon Rodriguez said she's seen families who treat their kids right away get lice again from the same outbreak because other families didn't act.
What do you do as a parent? Put them back in school with the same kids that have it? It's just a never-ending battle.
Stephanie Buck teaches at the Lively Preschool in Nashville that's getting over an infestation. She's scarred.
Because my daughter was really embarrassed when she found out that she was the first one who got checked and she had it. Man, it's hard. You want to protect your baby's hearts.
But she says you also want to keep your baby's lice-free, if you can. For NPR News, I'm Blake Farmer in Nashville.
The story was produced in partnership with KFF Health News. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 5:48, and you're tuned in to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. We receive support from Beltrami Electric Cooperative, your Touchstone Energy Cooperative, providing energy to keep lights on, coffee hot, and batteries charged, connecting communities and powering life in northern Minnesota for more than 80 years. More at beltramielectric.com. On the River is our volunteer hosted mix of folk, rock, jazz, blues, and world music on KAXE 7 days a week. Trained community members choose the music every weekday at 1 and 7, plus Saturdays at 4 and Sundays at 1. Big thanks to our dedicated volunteers. Applications are now open for the University of Minnesota Extension Master Gardener Volunteer Program. Learn how to share science-based horticulture knowledge with people in your area. The course begins in January, and the deadline to apply is October 1st. To learn more, visit z.umn.edu or contact your local extension office. The Minnesota Board of Water and Soil Resources offers the Lawns to Legumes program to increase habitat for at-risk pollinators in residential settings. The deadline for the 2026 season is November 30th. Find more info and apply at bluethumb.org. The nonprofit iLink Minnesota helps those with low vision and blindness by providing technology-based solutions. You may find more information and donate by searching for iLink Minnesota. That's I spelled E-Y-E. The Pine River Bacchus Community Garden celebrates its 15th season with an open house and community meal Monday, September 8th from 3:30 to 6 with live music, games for kids, and prize drawings. Located just west of the football field at Pine River Bacchus School. Now we'll take you back to All Things Considered here on member-supported KAXE KBXE.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers. If you spend time scrolling on social media, you are no doubt used to seeing a lot of weird stuff. Lately, more and more videos online are made with artificial intelligence. Critics say many of them serve no purpose other than attracting eyeballs and generating revenue, but millions of people are watching. NPR's John Ruich waded into the wild world of what some call AI slop.
This short video on YouTube is pretty typical of what's been proliferating online these days. It starts with a cartoon kitten sitting by a pool of rainbow goo. Then his buff cat dad appears neck deep in it.
Dad, can I swim in the slime pool?
No, son, I'm stuck. Please help me.
The simplistic animation and computer voiceovers are a dead giveaway that it was made with AI. And it's also goofy and kind of endearing, and it's been seen over 2 million times. Critics call this AI slop, as in pig slop, because they argue it's shoveled onto the internet and consumed in huge quantities. Adam Bumis works at the tech-focused newsletter Garbage Day. He says that's the whole point.
I don't think this video exists for any creative, any expressive, any informational or educational reason. It is purely to be engaged with.
The more engagement, the more views, the better for creators, like the owner of the channel that posted this clip.
My name is Mark Lawrence Gary Lau, and I am 21 years old.
Gary Lau is a computer science student in the Philippines. To him, making AI videos is creative and fun and a way to use a new technology.
I use ChatGPT to generate the images and then use this app called Kling AI to make those images into video using AI as well.
He produces one or two clips a day.
When I think of the story or what the dialogue would be, I would just sit there and think of a random one, which I find funny. That's it.
They all have a similar theme. The kitten does something goofy and his dad gets exasperated, like in this next video, where the kitten is flying a blimp made of pancakes and his dad is pointing him out to the police.
Dad, check this pancake blimp.
Nice.
There he is, officer. He stole my...
It might seem crazy, but Gary Lau says there's good money in it. YouTube owner Google pays channel owners based on the number of people who watch the videos and see ads. Gary Lau says he makes a few cents for every 1,000 views his short videos get. His channel, Funtastic YT, has racked up nearly 500 million views.
The highest I made was in the month of May. I made $9,000 in just 1 month.
For perspective, he says that's more than a year's salary in the kind of entry-level job he can expect when he graduates. Not everyone is psyched about all these AI videos, though.
AI is really super powering spam.
That's Jason Kebler, co-founder of the tech news website 404 Media.
I think that discoverability on the internet has already started to collapse.
That means it's harder for what he calls human creators, like photographers and artists, to stand out. Social media platforms recognize the challenge of AI-generated content. TikTok and Instagram label some of it. Meta says Facebook and Instagram users can shape their experience to see more of what they want to and less of what they don't. TikTok says it has rules against AI deepfakes. YouTube has a new policy that bars people from making money off what it calls inauthentic content, which includes mass-produced and repetitive videos. At the same time, though, YouTube is also encouraging video creators to use AI through features on its app that do things like generate fake backgrounds. Kepler says he doesn't think social media platforms are really taking a hard stand against AI content because they're all invested in it.
I think that they think that maybe this stuff is annoying now, but in 5 years, they imagine a world where most content on the internet is generated by AI, but it's content that people are going to want to see.
Mark Lawrence Igarilao says plenty of people want to see his AI videos, although some comments accuse him of producing AI slop.
At first, I was like, oh man, why do they hate my content?
Now he gives those comments a heart emoji and thanks them, because the more engagement, the better. John Ruich, NPR News.
A note that Google, which owns YouTube, and Meta are financial supporters of NPR, but we've always covered them like any other company.
Support for All Tech Considered comes from Capital One. With the Capital One Saver Card, what's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com.
We're used to thinking of giraffes as one species. Turns out there are actually four distinct species of the world's tallest mammal. That's according to a review published in August by the International Union for Conservation of Nature.
This is really, really big news because now that it is officially recognized, it will hopefully help us raise awareness for giraffe.
That's Steph Fennessy, the director of the Giraffe Conservation Foundation, which participated in the research.
Other people have a life. We have giraffe.
Her organization has been researching giraffe DNA for more than 20 years, initially to help American zoos.
We started collecting DNA samples. At that time, we had realized that there was something really fascinating going on in the wild, that there was probably different types of giraffe that were so significantly different that they could be considered different species.
So they did a DNA analysis of about 2,000 samples and scanned more than 500 giraffe skulls. Fennessy says they found significant differences between the four species.
I mean, a giraffe is still a giraffe, but a bear is also a bear. And the genetic difference between two giraffe species is bigger than the difference between a brown bear and a polar bear.
She believes the official recognition of these four species will help with conservation efforts. See, previously, giraffes were classified as one species with several subspecies, and the IUCN Red List of Threatened Species lists giraffes overall as vulnerable.
And then they listed some of the subspecies as endangered or even critically endangered. Talking about subspecies becomes quite complicated, and people are not really that interested when you start going into so much technical detail.
Now, countries and nonprofits can pay special attention to the species that are more endangered than others, like the northern giraffe, with just over 7,000 remaining in the wild,
which makes them one of the most endangered large mammals in the wild.
The review will now be used to guide upcoming IUCN assessments of endangered species. Fennessy hopes this new designation will make it easier for groups like the Giraffe Conservation Foundation to raise awareness and funding.
We hope it makes our life and our work a little bit easier, but my life hasn't changed overnight, unfortunately. I had hoped that lots of people would have come and said, here's money and help us save giraffe, but still to come.
In the meantime, her foundation will continue teaching people about these animals and working to increase their numbers. Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Workday. Workday is an AI platform for forward thinkers,
dedicated to transforming the way business leaders manage people, money, and agents today so they can transform tomorrow. Workday, moving business forever forward. From Luminescence Foundation. Luminescence Foundation is dedicated to shedding light on neurological research focused on Alzheimer's and Parkinson's diseases and supporting land conservation initiatives. And from the Cy Sims Foundation, since 1985, supporting advances in science, education, and the arts towards a fairer, more just, and civil society. More information is available at cysimsfoundation.org.
You are listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids and 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji. We are Northern Community Radio, telling the stories of the people and land of Northern Minnesota through music, news, conversation, and events. Operating translator K210DR in Brainerd at 89.9. Listen at KAXE.org or on your smart speaker. We need people like you to support this local media. Text the word donate to 218-326-1234. Thank you. We receive support from the First National Bank of Coleraine since 1906.